5 foot 2, and he's 6 feet 4. He fights with missiles and with spears. He's all of 31, and he's only 17. He's been a soldier for 1,000 years. He's a Catholic, a Hindu, an atheist, a Jain, a Buddhist and a Baptist and a Jew. And he knows he shouldn't kill, and he knows he always will kill you for me, my friend, and me for you. And he's fighting for Canada, he's fighting for France, he's fighting for the USA. And he's fighting for the Russians, and he's fighting for Japan, and he thinks we'll put an end to war this way. And he's fighting for democracy, he's fighting for the Reds, he says it's for the peace of all. He's the one who must decide who's to live and who's to die, and he never sees the writing on the wall.
Could you, let's get a little background for our listeners. I know you listening would like to know just a little bit about him, and we'll let you just tell a little bit about yourself and your background, and then how you got into some of the writing.
All right. Well, I was actually a young person wanting to go to West Point and be an officer and go fight in the Vietnam War. And I thought, well, you know, I ought to know something about this. And I started looking into the French colony of Indochina from way back when. Thus, in fact, that Dien Bien Phu book actually comes from stuff that I started doing before I did any of the rest of this.
Oh, really?
But anyway, the war had already begun. I was in high school. It moved closer to when it was time to apply, and I was trying to, you know, finalize my idea of and look for somebody who might support an application like that. And the Tet Offensive happened, and I began to realize that all these things that you know, we were being told about the war just weren't true. And I was already looking at the war. And it really turned my head around. In fact, I never applied to West Point. I went to college. I learned more and more about Vietnam. Actually, I was not a veteran. I was part of the anti-war movement.
Ah, good for you.
All right.
Good for you. So how did you... what was the first book that you wrote on Vietnam?
The first book I wrote on Vietnam was about that crisis in 1954 at the Dien Bien Phu.
Oh, that's
the book. Great. Operation Vulture is actually a new and reworked edition of that book, which was my second actual book.
Mm-hmm.
And then after that, I did Valley of Decision on the Quezon battle.
Mm-hmm.
After that, then, was The Hidden History of the Vietnam War.
That's the one
you read.
That's the one I just finished reading. That's a great book, John.
Thank you very much. More recently, I did a biography of Bill Colby, the CIA guy.
Yeah, right.
Who was in Vietnam as station chief, and then headed the Far East Division at the time of the Diem assassination, and then came back to Vietnam in the pacification program.
Oh, that's a nasty one. That
definitely.
That was a nasty one.
Didn't he go fishing one night and wind up dead?
Yes, that's correct.
Yeah, he just happened to not show up. Yeah, I want to talk, you know, most Americans think, or, you know, still think to this day that the American portion of the Vietnam War really started in 1964. But they don't understand that President Kennedy sent advisors over in 1961, but they were in Vietnam before that. Can you talk a little bit about how Eisenhower, his thinking on why he wanted to send American troops into Vietnam?
Yes, the American commitment actually started with Eisenhower's predecessor, Harry Truman, who started very strong financial support for the French military in the Indochina War. And that increased over time to the point that when Eisenhower took over, we were already funding a significant proportion of the French war in Indochina, and we were looking at proposals from the French to finance even more. But there was a big issue because Americans didn't think that the French were dealing right with the Vietnamese or training the Vietnamese right or any of that, and we were always pushing at the envelope trying to get a bigger involvement at that time under both Truman and Eisenhower. And that led to some of the decisions that set us up when the French got into this big battle at Dien Bien Phu and looked like they were losing and came to us and said, well, we need more. We need real help. We need bombing. We need, you know, whatever you can give us. And we actually sent Air Force mechanics over to Vietnam to maintain the French planes, and some of our guys got captured.
What year was that?
That was 1954. 54? Five Americans were captured in the Vietnam War in 1954.
Mm-hmm. Didn't
now so different 54 from 64 that the Vietnamese liberated those American prisoners and let them go. But nevertheless, they were captured down around Da Nang in 1954. And the guys over in Washington were saying, well, you know, this is easy. You know, we can use airplanes. We can use the Navy. We never have to send troops. The Army disagreed. They said, well, you know, you start that way, but you're going to end up with the Army in there, and there's no other way to do it. They were essentially right, and they won the argument, and Eisenhower didn't actually make that intervention. But I think that he felt guilty after the French lost that battle and lost the war and the Geneva agreements were made. And the result was that he upped our support for the South Vietnamese. Even before Kennedy got there, we were doing things like playing games with the number of American advisors who were supposedly permitted under the agreements and sending in temporary, quote-unquote, missions as a means to actually up the number of advisors. And in fact, the number that's usually taken for the number of American advisors that were there at the time that Kennedy took over, that number 785,
wow,
that number was actually made up of the guys that were in the military advisory group in 1954 at the time of this agreement, plus a bunch of the military attachés and everybody else who was there. They sort of grandfathered them in as a way to increase the base number.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're quite right about what you said about Kennedy. I mean, In the 3 years that Kennedy was president before he was assassinated, that number of American advisors went from 785 to almost 12,000. So the whole scale of the operation just went right up. It was an exponential growth in the size of the U.S. involvement.
We're listening to John Prados. P-R-A-D-O-S, and we're going to give a little website, some places you can look some things up a little later on here on Veterans Voice, KBOO Portland. You see how we slip that little station thing in? We do that about once every 15 minutes, so we'll do that again. Bill had something for
John,
you, John.
As I remember, or as I recall, Nixon wanted Eisenhower to provide the French with an atom bomb or a nuclear weapon during the final stages of the Indochina War, the French Indochina War. And Eisenhower, in his wisdom, denied the request. Is that correct?
Well, that's a good story, but it's a little bit different.
Okay.
All of the you know, we had this whole national security doctrine at the time. It was called the New Look. And it was based on the supposition that we couldn't fight every battle with conventional forces, so we were going to use tactical nuclear weapons.
Mm.
So all of these planning documents routinely included this language about using atomic weapons in tactical situations. And the Nguyen Phu and this big French crisis, that was that kind of a tactical situation. Now, somebody mentioned this proposition, and it, to this day, it's not clear exactly who. Nixon, you're right, Nixon discusses it in his memoirs, but that discussion reflects a meeting that actually happened without Nixon. It happened between Eisenhower and his national security advisor, a man named Robert Cutler. And they talked about the idea of nuclear weapons and the question of whether they might lend some to the French. And the records on that don't say that a decision was made one way or the other. However, there's a different record, a record of the American Secretary of State talking to French diplomats at a meeting in Paris. And the French foreign minister, in fact, in the memoir that he wrote years later about this period, talked about an American offer of A-bombs, offered to give them A-bombs to use in Indochina, which he says he rejected out of hand. Americans denied that there was any truth to these reports, but in the summer of 1954, when we were, for public relations purposes, preparing a so-called white paper to discuss what had happened in the Indochina crisis, we circulated it to the British and the French, who had all dealt with us during that crisis and during the Geneva negotiations, and we asked their comments. And the French diplomats came back to us and said, well, this looks good as far as it goes, but what happened to the proposal to lend us A-bombs? And the Americans immediately said, you know, nothing like that ever happened. But in fact, we never issued that white paper. The draft of it sat in government files for many years until it was declassified in the early 1980s. So there isn't a record that we approved giving the French A-bombs, but there are records that say that we made an offer, but the records come from the French side as opposed to the American one.
Yes, I was at a place called Desert Rock in 1951 during a series of nuclear tests.
One of the atomic veterans.
Yeah, he's an atomic vet.
Oh, my gosh.
And the purpose of these series of tests, they were called Buster Jangle. There were two series. And they were to develop tactical nuclear weapons. And that was that's what piques my interest in that aspect of the this military adventure that we embarked on.
So,
well, absolutely. Yeah. Not only did they have these discussions, I will tell you that there was a plan. That is to say that I encountered a Navy veteran who went through Navy special weapons training now about 2 years after Dien Bien Phu, and the lesson that they got on planning laydown of tactical atomic weapons was a brushed up version of a contingency plan to use them at Dien Bien Phu.
Really?
That's right.
Wow. You know, we also hear a lot about that when Tricky Dick Nixon was the president, that he also talked about using nuclear weapons in Vietnam. Is that true?
Well, Nixon himself said at one point that there were four times in his presidency that he considered using nuclear weapons, one of them being in Vietnam. But the times that he plotted action in Vietnam, that is, big escalation against the North, one of them being in late 1969, which was never carried out, and the other one being in 1972, with the Haiphong mining and the Christmas bombing.
Right.
Um, none of the planning documents that we've seen, at least so far, out of the Nixon era indicate that there were nuclear weapons involved in either of those two situations.
Mm-hmm.
However, it is true that in the 1969 situation, what Nixon did do was order a nuclear alert. So he alerted the Strategic Air Command and the missile forces and the submarine missile forces, but the purpose of that was essentially diplomatic as opposed to military, not actually to strike North Vietnam, but to scare the Russians so much that they would lean on the North Vietnamese to come around to our demands in the negotiations.
Yeah. Mike, you wanted to say something?
Well, John, my name is Mike Casey. I was a medic in Vietnam, and that was my thinking is that it was a posturing by the Nixon administration to scare, you know, the North Vietnamese that, you know, I mean, Nixon was known as the madman, and I have a feeling that probably was a big part of it, was just to scare the North Vietnamese, and God only knows what other stuff was, you know, the U.S. delivered to the North Vietnamese as far as, you know, under-the-wire threats or whatever.
You know, John, I want to say something before we start asking. You do something in your books that most writers don't do. You spelt Vietnam right. You did. And most people put Vietnam as one word.
Right.
And you that's the one thing when I started reading the first book that when I got there I saw Vietnam. And you're one of the very few guys who do that. And that's great.
You very much. I appreciate that.
Yeah, it's
I have to tell you though, I can't make that work anymore. No one will print it that way.
Not only did we try to destroy their country, we tried to rename it, huh?
Something like that.
Respell
right.
The whole thing. But I thought that was great when you did that. That was amazing. I want to talk.
John, I have a question. This is JT. I'm along with Marvin, Vietnam vet, 69, 70.
68.
And,
I was 68.
So the interesting thing is that when it's... our involvement was really more with the French initially than with Vietnam. And I wonder if you could address the issue a little bit of why there was never really a policy on our part coming out of Congress or the government as to what our policy with Vietnam and what we wanted our policy to be, and any work towards saying, here's a country that really had the potential to be our friend. It seemed like more we were just sucked in because the French were there, and after all, we're friends with the French, so we got to help our buddies. Where was Congress and our policymakers in all this and never coming up with a clear policy on Vietnam?
I would say that there were scattered people in Congress. For example, Senator Mansfield, who for a time was the Democratic majority leader in the Senate, who had some kind of a vision of Vietnamese nationalism. John Kennedy, actually, as a representative in the House, also articulated a relatively advanced view. And the Eisenhower administration had rhetoric about independence for the Vietnamese, Laotians, and Cambodians within the French Union. But the French were very successful in terms of selling the communist threat to Washington. And they succeeded in portraying Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh as nothing more than another tentacle of the Moscow octopus reaching out to take over the world. And under those terms, the Americans should just wholeheartedly support the French and not pay too much attention to their, that is the French, refusal to really accord full independence to the Vietnamese. Now, when the French got out and we kind of took over, that anti-communist side of it continued, although we were much more at that point attuned to the idea of Vietnamese nationalism, but then it had to be nationalism of a certain kind. It had to be anti-communist nationalism as opposed to simply dealing with Vietnamese and the Vietnamese people. And I think we were trapped in that kind of anti-communist mentality throughout that period, and it continued under Kennedy, who in a sense went back on those sort of sophisticated views that he'd held in the early 1960s. And in Johnson, Johnson at the time of Dien Bien Phu was the Senate minority leader, and his thinking about it was lockstep with the Eisenhower administration people and their anti-communist views. And he continued to hold that view. He was very impressed with CM. This is now moving into the Kennedy period when he's vice president. He was very impressed with CM as an American ally, an anti-communist ally. And he continued to hold those views as president. So they locked themselves into that kind of an ideological situation.
So how did the U.S. feel towards Bao Dai?
That's a very interesting question, though. I think Bao Dai is one of the sort of under-evaluated, under-related characters in the whole Vietnam story. He's just typical. He's typically pictured as a caricature, as a person who is simply out-partying, essentially, and not paying any attention to anything going on around him. And he's actually a much more complex character than that, and I think he has some credentials as a Vietnamese nationalist. He was a man who was willing to resign his, or renounce, I guess is the right word, renounced his emperorship at the time of the August Revolution of 1945 and live as a private citizen. And he did that. The French brought him back when they were trying to create some kind of a Vietnamese government that they could say was an independent government under the French Union. And in that situation, Bao Dai made his calculations of who was top and who was not, and how to sort of protect the Vietnamese people under the circumstances that prevailed at the time. And he did a fairly good job of doing that. He was accused of corruption, and that's probably true, but on the other hand, there was all kinds of corruption all over the place over there. And he was robbed of his nationalist credentials. But when you come right down to it, it was Bao Dai who appointed Ngo Dinh Diem as prime minister of South Vietnam. Yes, it was.
Wow.
Before Diem took over, he overthrew Bao Dai in a coup in 1955.
Wow. Yeah, people, you know, our listeners, the Bao Dai was the last emperor in Vietnam. He was the very last emperor. And like you say, they brought they did bring him back, and then they got rid of him again. So, and I want to talk a little bit when we get going.
Yeah, let's just let them know that this satisfies everybody. For those of you, this will be a big surprise. You're listening to KBOO Portland, Veterans Voice, and we're from Northwest Veterans for Peace. Our guest today is John Prados, P-R-A-D-O-S, and we're talking about some of the material from some of the books that he has written.
Right. The one I'm starting the book now, Operation Vulture, and it's very interesting. Can you tell the listeners what Operation Vulture was?
Operation Vulture was the plan to save the French at Dien Bien Phu by means of an American aerial bombardment that would be carried out by heavy B-29 bombers and by carrier aircraft flying from the South China Sea.
And so that didn't last very long, did it?
Well, it was never carried out.
Oh, really?
As the book explains, the various diplomatic maneuvers that occurred at the time around arranging the circumstances for this, and then the military feasibility studies that were done about carrying it out went in different directions. The Americans couldn't put together the kind of justification that they thought they needed for political cover in order to execute this operation. And during all the period when they were rushing around trying to do that, trying to establish the conditions for the intervention, the battle at Dien Bien Phu was continuing, and the French finally lost it. So before they could put together the conditions, the situation disappeared.
And so basically the U.S. had no help for the French anyway, so the war ended. Let's go. Now I want to get started on the before we go to the Gulf of Tonkin, do you think that the reason that Eisenhower was in Vietnam was to support the French to have them stay in NATO? And also, was there thinking that they wanted to use the French in Vietnam to stop what they considered the spread of communism?
That's an excellent question. We have not at all discussed the whole situation of Franco-American diplomacy. And what was going on during this period was this idea of the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, upgrading itself to become a major military alliance, in great part by arming the West Germans. Now, since we just finished fighting this big war against Germany in World War II, there was a lot of concern about arming Germans. No matter who they were supposedly going to be fighting for.
That's right.
And that was certainly true with the French. And the French proposed a scheme, something that was called the European Defense Community, that would have been acceptable to it would have been acceptable to them to create units of armed Germans, provided that they were part of other units that also included other nationalities, such as French and British and Americans and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And this became this whole scheme called the European Defense Community. And the European Defense Community issue was politically sensitive and was being negotiated out and fought out in domestic politics in Germany and in France, but in particular in France, during this very same 1953-54 period that we see in the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. And an important part of the American motivation in supporting the French in Indochina was in order to keep them pushing the line on NATO and the European Defense Community to make sure that this rearmament program moved forward and they got these troops, they got these German troops into the field in NATO. So you've got that going on the one hand, and you do have the anti-communist issue that we did talk about a bit before,
right,
also going on at the same time. Eisenhower, I think, actually felt himself torn a little bit, you know, because he had complaints about French colonialism, and he didn't like the idea of the French not perfecting the independence of the Vietnamese state. But at the same time, he was being driven by these considerations of the NATO alliance and this argument about anti-communism. And I think this kind of... I mentioned before that I thought he felt guilty after the Dien Bien Phu fiasco. Part of that, I think, is because he recognized that he had been divided himself in his feelings of against French anti-colonialism versus these other considerations that were going on.
Go ahead, Bill. Go ahead and ask him.
Yeah, one of the things that I recall about the Vietnam War was the influence of the rubber industry and the French Michelin Company wanting to protect their
resources and charging the there was some sort of repatriation or recompense or some darn thing regarding the number of rubber trees that were destroyed, and could you elaborate on that? My memory is pretty sketchy in that regard.
Well, that's okay. Yes, north of Saigon, in the part of Vietnam that was often called War Zone D, there were extensive rubber plantations. And as you say, a number of them belonged to Michelin, some belonged to independent contractors and whatnot. On the overall economic scale, rubber was not actually one of the major products of Vietnam. But from the standpoint of the Michelin company and some of the particular contractors, naturally it was important.
Mm-hmm.
And very early on, in fact, during this Kennedy advisory phase, when we were ramping up the numbers of advisors and we were starting to go into the field with the South Vietnamese Army, they made arrangements, we're talking about the planters now, made arrangements with the U.S. Embassy for recompense for war damage. And as the war continued and got more intense and so much fighting took place in War Zone C and D, and some of these plantations were pretty heavily shot up, naturally a lot of this stuff, a lot of recompense had to be paid. It was embarrassing, though, you know, because we were giving some minimal recompense to Vietnamese families whose members were shot up during the course of military operations. You know, we were giving, at certain points, more money to the rubber planters than to the Vietnamese families.
Yeah.
Economics and war. It's interesting that... I want to change just a little bit. You talked about Kennedy, and I was struck by, again, hearing the tremendous increase of number of advisors. And I put the word advisors in quotes because that's what was palatable to the people. But can you address that large increase in number by any stretch of the imagination was really military more than advisors? And isn't that what really set the stage to draw the military in full?
Yes, that's a very good point. You know, you could, what is an advisor? You know, we have these advisors that they talk to the Vietnamese and they take points from them and they help them and whatnot. And you can assign advisors to every Vietnamese ministry and to every office of every Vietnamese ministry. And then you can go into the army. The Vietnamese Army had 9 divisions at that time. Mm. You could assign an advisory team to every division. You could go down to battalion level with 3 or 4 guys. And at the end of that whole process, you know, with the most advisors you could figure out how to get in there, you'd be up around, say, 2,000 people. That doesn't account for the 12,000 that we got in there. And the difference is that we started all these other things, all these other programs to increase what we thought of as South Vietnamese combat capability, and most of that was combat support.
Mm.
And by when we got into combat support, what that meant was companies of helicopters that were flying the Vietnamese troops into battle. That was really a combat function. Special forces guys who were organizing Vietnamese irregular combat units and leading them out on patrols. That was really a combat function. Similar special forces and CIA clandestine operations guys who were organizing commando attacks on North Vietnam, also a military function. A whole series of things like this. Oh, the bombing, I should not neglect.
Right.
We had a special Air Force unit that was bombing and strafing, and the beginnings of the defoliation program, Ranch Hand, all occurred mm-hmm. during this period as part of this so-called combat support. And the idea was, well, it would be an American air mission, but if there was a South Vietnamese crew member in the airplane, then you could say you were training them.
Yeah, there you go.
Right, and the And the result of the whole thing, of course, in terms of just logic, is since we had all these American forces, or not American advisors there, or Americans there, we certainly had to protect them and protect our interests. So it's logical then that you got to have some troops go in to help protect those people.
Yeah.
And yeah, so there, it's no end to the escalation and the tunnel that it was sucking him into.
Yeah, my war was the Korean War, John, and it was one of the precursors of the Korean War was KMAG, which was Korean Military Assistance Group.
Absolutely.
And when I came back from Korea and the drums began beating again in Vietnam and they formed this VMAG organization, I knew that all hell was going to break loose, and it sure as hell did.
Yeah. John, I want to ask, I wish we had another hour, but
that's the way Veterans Voice is, yeah, on KBOO Radio.
John, what was the latest release by the National Security Agency on the Gulf of Tonkin that really came out and showed what happened on August 4th?
Yeah.
Absolutely. The National Security Agency recently released a set of 160 documents about the Gulf of Tonkin, most of which are the raw intercepts of North Vietnamese communications traffic that we picked up during the days from just before the first Gulf of Tonkin incident on August the 2nd until after the alleged second incident that supposedly occurred on August the 4th. The collection also includes higher level reports, that is, summary reports that were based on all of this local reporting, and chronologies that were done to later on as part of major studies of the Gulf of Tonkin, and then a retrospective historical narrative study that was done by a National Security Agency historian.
Mm-hmm.
And what the material shows is that the early assertions by the Johnson administration officials of North Vietnamese attack on August the 4th were actually based on only a very selective set of the intercepts, only ones from one particular station, while at the same time other stations were intercepting and reporting different information.
The same message. The same message, but different information. Is that right?
Some of the same messages, but also some different material. That is to say that the North Vietnamese had, after the August 2nd incident, where their torpedo boats were damaged, they had these damaged torpedo boats sitting out there in the Gulf of Tonkin. They had to mount a salvage operation to recover them. And a lot of the message traffic of that period actually pertains to the salvage operation.
Mm.
And the reports that claimed that the North Vietnamese were making ready for an attack on August the 4th and stuff like that were these higher-level summary reports which selected out of the traffic an apparently mistaken report from this one station that transposed the dates and times of the information it was reporting, which really pertained to the first incident.
The second, August 2nd.
That's right.
One of the things that really interested me on this stuff was that when they were the captain of the Maddox actually says that the Maddox was being shadowed by the Vietnamese torpedo boats, and that he turned the Maddox around and fired at the Vietnamese, fired the first shots at, and that was fired by the Maddox at the Vietnamese. That was really interesting to me, because I'd never heard that before.
Well, yeah, you're talking about August 2nd now.
Yeah, August 2nd, right.
That's right.
Right, that the U.S. fired the first shot, at that, and then the PT boats were destroyed.
Right. Well, they were watching the PT boats get closer to them, and they were afraid that they were going to get into torpedo range, so they wanted to drive them off.
And so they fired.
So yes, they did, in fact, fire first.
Fired first. And,
and the PT boats, their armament, you know, was like machine guns and light caliber cannon. They didn't have the range or striking power of the destroyer.
Right.
So they weren't even in range to shoot at the Americans at the time that the battle began.
Okay, I want to talk. You talked a little bit about these intercepts, and what I read was that the intercepts were the messages were intercepted at Fubai, and that Fubai, when they decoded and translated the messages, was different than the same message that was intercepted down in the Philippines and was decoded and interpreted differently.
That's correct.
And the ones that they sent to was a flash message or something. That's the one that got sent out. And then the one from the Philippines, the same message, which said something completely different, didn't get to them till later because it wasn't a flash message. And so they just kind of picked the message that they wanted.
I don't remember the point about precedence. You might be right about that.
Yeah.
I don't remember the point about communications precedence. But
right.
I do remember that that NSA headquarters picked and chose among the reports from the different stations in circulating what it said was happening. And the high-level people in Washington were just reading the summaries. They weren't reading the station intercepts.
Right. And plus, the U.S. really didn't have any really good Vietnamese-speaking people anyway at that time during the war. So they were just kind of counting on Americans who had been trained in the Vietnamese language. And I think that's really one of the problems, that two different translators were saying certain words meant something, and the other translator was saying it meant something else. So, you know, but
that's exactly right. There's a situation in some of these messages where certain wording was interpreted in one case, and this applies to these messages about the salvage of the damaged boats. Some people interpreted that as referring to boats that were damaged to the Americans and losses of boats, and other people were referring to it as reporting the seamen who were killed or wounded.
Yeah, it was complete. And one of the things that the Americans didn't understand at that time, there were two different programs going on that really worked together, but McNamara said they weren't. One was the DeSoto's, and the other one was the Operation Plan 34. And,
that's right.
And the Vietnamese figured it out that they were both working together. And the Operation Plan 34 was the one you talked a little bit about, where the Americans were training the South Vietnamese and also the hired mercenaries from Taiwan, I think they were. And they were going up and attacking the islands off in the Gulf of Tonkin and trying to get the Vietnamese to turn on their radar. And the DeSoto was part of that, but the American public wasn't told about it. And McNamara even lied, didn't he, about that?
Yes, he did. And it's quite puzzling, in fact, because these things were known in Washington. If you look at the telephone call transcripts, the telephone call tapes of McNamara's conversations with Lyndon Johnson at this time, and even some of Johnson's conversations with old Senate colleagues and stuff like this, they make specific references to the connection between the DeSoto patrols and the 34A operations. And yet, when they spoke in the Congress and to the public, they explicitly insisted that there was no connection between these two things.
Yep. They said they were setting them up.
John, we have about 7 minutes left, unfortunately. John, our guest is John Prados, has written excellent, excellent works in and around the Vietnam time and era, and we encourage you to get that. As we go through this information, John, we're hearing a lot of incidences and things that where some truth was told, some wasn't, there was some lack of understanding and so forth. Would you be kind enough to take a few minutes and tell us, from your research and all the knowledge that you've gained from this, what do you see as some of the lessons that we should learn from this, and then how and what relates to what's going on now?
Well, that's a very good question. Some of the lessons that we should have learned from Vietnam, there are so many, but let me just pick out a few. First, it was a big mistake to let a particular point of view, a particular ideological approach to the world, dominate our perceptions of actual situations in real places. I think we did that in the Vietnam War with anti-communism. I think we're we're in danger of doing that now.
Yes.
With this idea that terrorism is an ideology. Terrorism is an all-encompassing kind of enemy.
A monolithic one.
Right, a monolithic one. That's right. That's one. Another one is there's no substitute for real knowledge of real places.
Yes,
we went into the Vietnam War without listening to the people who knew about the area or taking to heart what they had to say to us about the players and what was going on. And again, I think...
And getting to know the people of the
country.
That's
right.
Knowing and the culture.
People. That's right. Another was the question of ends and means. In the Vietnam War, we tried to make the war fit our military as opposed to fighting the conflict that was happening.
Relevant.
Yeah.
And that, again, has relevance in the present situation, where I think that, you know, the current administration invaded Iraq to fight a war in Iraq because that's what it could do, as opposed to looking at the terrorism problem as an intelligence problem and dealing with it at that level.
Yeah. Yep.
Yes.
And we've led ourselves into a situation where we can't get out.
Yep.
And that's another lesson. We got into Vietnam, and getting in is always easier than getting out.
Yep.
Because we had forces, we had power, we could apply power, we did apply power, and once we were applying power, we could not extricate ourselves from that situation.
Yep.
And again, we've done the same thing with the Iraq War, where we've put forces into harm's way in an unstable political situation where now we tell ourselves, well, if we get out, then this whole thing is going to be a mess. Well, it is a mess. And the real question isn't, is it going to be a mess when we get out? The real question is, are we going to be more damaged now or later in terms of our interests and our potential in the Middle Eastern situation.
Okay, we have about 2 minutes.
John, I want to ask you a quick question. This is Mike Hasty again. Where do you see the U.S. involved in this war in Iraq in 5 years?
Wow.
Well, I don't know if I want a hazard or prediction there. I would say the outcome of the combat situation is indeterminate. You know, we have powerful forces there, and the adversary side does not seem to have a coherent or large-scale force, but it has such a distributed force and such a decentralized force that we can't cope with it. On the other hand, they haven't come up with a formula yet that damages us so much, like a battle of Dien Bien Phu, like a battle of Tet or of Khe Sanh, that damages us so much that everybody can see right up front, you know, hey, this is a disaster, no more of this.
Bill has
so
a quick question.
Evolution, I see an evolution. It's really a race between the disparate forces of resistance on the Iraqi side coming together and learning how to do that versus this race to put together an Iraqi government that's going to represent all the people. And I'm not sure that given the various religious and political divisions that exist in the nation of Iraq, that the enterprise of creating that government, whether it's democratic or whatever, can be successful within the kind of time frame we're talking about. And if that's true, that means that American forces are trapped, because we've got this logic here where we can't pull out until victory.
John, some of the people might like to contact you. Can you, what would you recommend on a website or people that were interested in following this up a little more? And according to the clock here, we have 1 minute.
Contact me through the National Security Archive in Washington, D.C. If you Google National Security Archive, it will lead you immediately to our website, and you can send me a message there.
Great. Okay, thank you so much for being on the program with us. And, John, we thank you for your work and hope you continue to do the good work and just receive all kinds of blessings for it.
Thanks, John.
Thank you very much. It was my pleasure.
Thanks, John.
Okay.
And we're glad that you're listening to Veterans Voice, so we appreciate it. We're on the final words. Do you have a final word, Marvin?
If you want to get some of John's books, go to Powell's. Powell's got some of John's books. And that's it. Then we'll be back next month. And upcoming is Andrew's coming up with his new and wonderful show. So bringing up our music.
Thank you.
Oh, I marched to the Battle of New Orleans at the end of the early British War. The young land started growing, the young blood started flowing, but I...